The following program is brought to you by Total Theater Online. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the staff or management of WGBB. You're listening to the station that serves your community, 1240 WGBB. And now it's time for Dave's Gone By with David Lefkowitz.
Captain's Log, episode number 122, Stardate Thursday, April 7th, 2005. There goes the Daverhood. Welcome, everybody, to Dave's Gone By. Quite an eventful week it has been, at least for the media. For the rest of us, basically, two people died. You had the Pope and Terry Schiavo. Now, not to belittle the loss of either, but media overkill was certainly working overtime on both. You had this poor woman in a vegetative state for two decades, and this internal family fight for the past 7 years, which then, suddenly, became a news story so big it actually bumped Michael Jackson off the front pages for a few days. And alas, so much of the coverage was not about the crucial issues at stake regarding end-of-life care. But as usual, the circus turned in on itself, and all the reportage was about should the president be involved, should Congress make a law, who has control over a spouse, a marital partner, or a parent, which are all beside the point, or at least secondary issues beyond the basic ones involving life or death decisions. I couldn't get over the chutzpah of the New York Post, which has shoved its share of Schiavo shite down our shuddering throats, suddenly backing off and saying, quite rightly, you know what? Enough of the maelstrom. The courts have ruled again and again. The family lost. The husband won. They've taken out the feeding tube. Let's all calm down because it is what it is, and that's it. And the New York Post saying that is a little like the Coca-Cola company releasing a statement that reads, Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, RC-Cola, they're all basically the same. You've probably made your choice by now. We're not going to influence you. But anyway, yes, I do have my thoughts about the whole Terry Schiavo thing and about the conundrum of her situation. It isn't black and white for me. It's not like pro-abortion, anti-abortion, pro-oil pipeline, anti-oil pipeline, where you can see the other side, but you can also put your foot down one way or the other. Schiavo straddled the fence of this life and the other, literally. So I'm going to try and walk that fence a little myself in this week's Dave Goes Off segment, coming up a little later. Not only that, I even have a Terry Schiavo song to sing. No, she did not write it. I wrote it about her. Be weird if she wrote a song. I mean, what would that sound like? No, but feel free to sing along later with Pull Out the Tube, the Terry Schiavo anthem. The lyrics are on my website, davesgoneby.com. Oh, and apologies to people who tried to access my website for a few days this past week. We had some terrible server problems. First, the page was down. Then it was pointing to another website. Pointing is where one URL directs you to another URL where the actual content is. And then for a day or two, somebody tampered with something and redirected my page to a porn site. And not just any porn portal, but one with links to, I'm not kidding, big boobs, bondage, and bestiality. And while I love all three, it was not my intention to link Dave's Gone By to that page, which I made very clear in a late-night tantrum to my webmaster, but the problem was finally fixed, thank goodness, and davesgoneby.com is now pointing merrily to its proper homepage, Dave's Gone By. And we also now have davesgoneby.org, just in case we suffer another .com, not com. So either one, davesgoneby.com or .org, you'll see the lyrics of Pull Out the Tube, the Terry Schiavo anthem, as well as another brand new song we're going to premiere on the show tonight. As I said, it was a big week in death. Not that anyone's surprised that John Paul finally joined George and Ringo, but let's face it, the Pope's death scene has been longer than Violetta's in La Traviata, and at least she didn't have to go to the window and wave every other day. I think the final words on the Pope's legacy were well spoken on this show a couple of weeks ago by Rabbi Saul Solomon, one of our regular guests. He pointed out that, overall, John Paul was pretty darn good, as popes go. He was accessible, he was learned, he had a sense of humor, he was a poet. I'm sure that his artistic leaning was part of the reason he didn't waste his time bitching about obscenity on TV or naughty lyrics in pop songs. He did take a lot of time and energy urging tolerance between nations, abstinence for young people, political freedom in oppressed countries. He was thrilled to see the Iron Curtain come down, and not so thrilled to see it slide immediately into corruption and despiritualized materialism. He worked hard to be a good dude. No wars, no schisms. He wasn't trying to convert other faiths. He wanted to make Catholics be better Catholics. And that's fine. His Achilles heel was abortion and birth control. As the rabbi said, you cannot expect the leader of the Catholic faith to support abortion. Early term, late term, it's not going to happen. In fact, if any pope were to take such a radical stance, it would probably cause a fracture in the whole Catholic community. So, let's resign ourselves to the pope's pro-life stance. But again, if you're going to force people to keep the baby they make, at least give them the option not to make a baby in the first place. And that's where Pope John Paul was, unfortunately, still too much in the Dark Ages. You can't acknowledge the existence of AIDS and venereal disease in overwhelming numbers throughout the world and then say, be celibate and expect the planet to listen. It hasn't worked. Condoms work, for the most part. And other contraceptive methods, besides trying to set a calendar to your woman's hoo-hoo, should be accepted and recommended. But that's for another pope at another time. I don't think we need to have an orgy of funeration for Pope John Paul II. I love how the news networks had 24-hour Vatican coverage the last 2 weeks. What was there to update? He was dying. He was an old man with all his systems failing. Whether it was going to be on Monday or Thursday or early Saturday morning, it's not a question of whether he's going to croak. It's a question of when. And yet, every 10 minutes, this body part has shut down. Now he's having trouble breathing. Now he's got a blood infection. All right already. We knew how it was going to turn out. Same thing with Terry Schiavo, and I think they were both using feeding tubes at one point, though I gather they would have left the popes in. Of course, once His Holiness died, it was time for all the pomp and circumstance, well, you know, pretty much Ronald Reagan Part 2, with every network in this orgiastic team coverage. My coverage begins and ends here, but we're going to send him out in style. I think it's appropriate to bid farewell to John Paul II in a musical way, with a hymn. So, if you all turn to webpage davesgoneby.com, verse 2, you can join me in this beautiful, transcendent psalm. Sister Mary Gretsch will be accompanying me on the guitar. She's not very good, and it's not really meant for a guitar, but unfortunately, we don't have a working organ. Then again, neither did John Paul. So please, everyone, rise and join me in the singing of Dead Popies. Dead Popies! Dead Popies! Dead Popies aren't much fun. They don't preach, they don't pray, all they do is rot away. Dead Popies aren't much fun, no, no, no. When Popies die, Cardinals sob, they want his blessing and his job. Dead Popies aren't much fun. The Pope is gone, God rest his soul. Tis one contribution to birth control. Dead Popies aren't much fun. Dead Popies, dead I don't know about you, but I feel cleansed. I feel renewed. I don't feel saved, but I feel Daved, which is appropriate because I am Dave. Dave Lefkowitz, radio personality, journalist, theater critic, and humorist, and this is my show, Dave's Gone By, airing weekly on AM 1240 WGBB in Freeport, New York, and live streaming on the web at am1240wgbb.com. Every week, we bring you a mix of comedy, talk radio, music, and interviews, and what do you know? We've done it again this week. As I said, I'll be weighing in on the whole Terry Schiavo rigmarole in a segment called Dave Goes Off. We also have the Schiavo song to do, and a special guest. We've got some great guests coming up all month long on Dave's Gone By, one after the other. It's pretty exciting. Tonight, the man who played a Ferengi in two different Star Trek shows. He was Letek in Star Trek The Next Generation, that's the one with Patrick Stewart, and he played Quark in Deep Space Nine, the one with Kate Mulgrew. Now, I'm not a Trekkie. I've never been big on the whole SF genre, not even the first Star Trek. It's not my thing, although my wife, Joyce, likes to watch Deep Space Nine now and again, so I've seen several episodes, and they're quite enjoyable. I mean, they usually follow the same course. Some enemy ship comes along, disables part of the deck, or immobilizes the crew members, and then they think of a clever way to save the day and cut a few miles off their 8-million-year journey home. It's fun stuff, and I do enjoy the Quark character. But that's not why I'm interviewing Armin Shimerman tonight on Dave's Gone By. He's my guest in the neighborhood because he's doing a play in L.A., not just any play, but King Lear. Now, he's not old enough to be tackling the lead role, but he does have a pretty key featured part, the fool. The fool, who, of course, is wiser than the monarch he serves. Armin Shimerman is appearing in King Lear at San Diego Repertory through April 17th, so if you're out there or visiting the West Coast between now and then, go check it out. The reviews have been mixed to positive, with Armin getting really nice notices. So, we will talk with him about Shakespeare, about Star Trek, about the books he's written, about acting in general, in about 20 minutes. All that tonight on Dave's Gone By, which is brought to you by Hewlett Minuteman Press, the copy shop that never stops, well, 5 days a week, on Broadway in Hewlett. They really are the best when it comes to printing and binding and photocopying and all that businessy stuff. And our other great sponsor, TotalTheater.com, publishers of Performing Arts Insider Theater magazine. Remember that this show is rated DGB-13 for possible mature content. I probably should have told you that before the Pope song, but what's done is done, and we'll do much, much more right after this.
If I were a rich man,
if I were a rich man, I could do the Dave's Gone By show for years and years and never have to worry about money. But that's not the way things have worked out. So, I need your help. You can help me by helping yourself by advertising or sponsoring segments on Dave's Gone By. It's easy, it's cheap. Just go to davesgoneby.com and see the rate card, davesgoneby.com, and bring your message to my listeners and make us both rich.
Big tall house with the rose.
Jimmy, did you go home and write 1,000 times, "I will not disturb the class"?
Here, Mrs. Ditchbarb.
Psst, Jimmy, you were playing softball last night. How'd you do it?
Easy. I went to Hewlett Minuteman Press and made copies.
Hewlett Minuteman Press?
1315 Broadway. They copy everything at a great price. I could have even had it bound and laminated.
Jimmy?
Yes, Mrs. Ditchbarb.
Look what I found! A receipt! Uh-oh! Here's your change!
Ow! 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 Ow!
Dave goes off. Dave goes off. Dave goes off. Dave goes off.
Well, Dave goes off indeed. I probably couldn't get away from the whole Terry Schiavo media circus death thing after all of that and just sort of let it go and not comment about it. So I wanted to get my jumbled thoughts about it in order, and I wanted to start talking about it through this amazing classic American moment of disconnect that I experienced a weekend or so ago when I was in Manhattan I was heading towards the theater and walking down the east side, or up Madison Avenue, I should say, somewhere in the 30s or low 40s. And there's, on one side of the street, there's a Burger King on the left, and they had, like, these 99-cent double cheeseburgers that looked amazing. And yet I had all my willpower after seeing Super Size Me, and it's convinced me to try and eat a lot less of places like McDonald's and Burger King and Wendy's and stuff. And so I passed it up, even though I was hungry. And I think I got a pizza later, so I didn't really follow all the rules. But still, kept on walking, didn't cross over the street. And then on my right was a McDonald's. Now, this is one of those new fancy McDonald's, not one of the old style, or even one of the ones that are meant for kids with pictures of the, or big sculptures of the Hamburglar and slides and things. No. And this is one of those New York upscale, almost antiseptic McDonald's. And I didn't go in. I was just passing it. I wasn't even noticed it. Except, there were the arches out front. I look in, and it's very spacious and very kind of gray and steely. And, there's a few people standing on the lines. And above them, above the counters, were this row of television screens, all about 10 or 12 inches. So I guess that's a new thing now. Instead of playing Muzak or music when you go into places like my local bank now has a television set. So you go in, you stand online, and you actually have something to watch. You watch CNN. And that is, to me, better than music you really don't want to hear playing over a loudspeaker. And they've got it at the McDonald's, too. They're playing CNN on each and every one of these, like 10 or 15 television sets, all in a row, spanning all across the store, way above the heads of the people standing online. And what was magnificent about that moment was they kept showing on those screens, while I was standing there, the pictures of Terri Schiavo, I guess it was 2 years ago, when she was still somewhat, like, lucid, but already out of it completely. Well, she wasn't lucid, obviously, but she still had her weight, had her figure, or her obesity, whatever it was. So there's this horrible, sort of sad portrait of this dying, endlessly dying woman who is through a feeding tube and was at that time being starved to death because they pulled the feeding tube, and that was what was all in the news. And here are these people about 10 feet below those screens ordering double cheeseburgers and french fries without, and there was just no connection between what they were doing and this woman being starved to death above them. I found that rather magnificently American. But let me get to the meat of the whole, meat being the ironic operative term, of the whole Schiavo thing. It's her specific case was such a conundrum, because if you're thinking about pulling the feeding tube and letting her starve to death, there were two basic questions. One is, was she conscious at all in any way or feeling any kind of pain or discomfort? Now, here's the deal. If she was in pain, well, certainly she should have been allowed to die. I mean, this is no fair keeping someone in agony for, 15, 20 years. The problem with that is the way of killing her is starving to death. So if she's feeling pain, that means for about a week and a half, she was in just awful agony of starvation and feeling it. So that's cruelty. However, on the other side of things, if Terri Schiavo was in a completely vegetative state, felt nothing, she was just a total block of wood lying there, fine, cool. If you starve her to death, you pull out the tube, she gets no nourishment, she's not going to notice. It's okay. She's just gone, and all that's there is the physical, so when she starves, she'll die, and there's no pain involved. The only question is, still very Talmudic when I talk like this, but if she was feeling no pain, feeling nothing, then what was the big rush to kill her? Maybe the parents were right. If she's just lying there and not enduring anything bad, she's just there, maybe dreaming of something, but not necessarily a bad dream, why kill her? Why not take the risk of the 99.99999% against it, but maybe there would be a miracle someday, or a miraculous cure? Why kill her if she's not feeling any pain? So I really don't even know where I would stand on all that. And I think it is kind of funny that the husband was so bitter, and actually pretty sad. He wouldn't even let her parents visit in her last hours, or didn't want them at the funeral. He objected to their wanting her buried. You know, he cremated her. And you get the feeling he was just so angry at them for keeping him in court for 7 years that he almost wants to drive up to their house one morning, ring the bell, you know, have them open the door and throw her ashes in their face, going, "See, I won, I won," you know? But for me, the real lesson learned in this whole Terri Schiavo case is one, and a lot of people are learning this one, go and get yourself a living will, because you could be hit by a bus tomorrow, or today, you know, if you're really unlucky. And the other is making those contingency plans for yourself, and also having contingency plans in place for our government and judiciary, so that there are ways to mercifully and easily and nicely kill people, even if it does smack of, like, Soylent Green. You know, one of the ridiculous tragedies in this nation is that Dr. Kevorkian is wasting away in prison when his last years should have been about sitting on panels for federal justices and roundtables at Johns Hopkins and Sloan Kettering, giving his ideas of how mercy killing and euthanasia can really work in the best way. A person who wants to leave this life should have the personal choice to do X, Y, and Z. Follow these nice directions. Or if the person is physically incapacitated, an authorized doctor should have that right. And I strongly believe that, and I think I even made that clear when I had author Larry Quachi on the show a couple of weeks ago talking about the decision he almost had to make when he was 17 years old and his mother was riddled with cancer and she begged him to kill her. And just at the, you know, the last moment before he would have had to put a pillow over her face, she died earlier that evening. So he got lucky, as it were. But still, we are not coming to terms properly in this country with what to do, especially with so many people getting old and indigent, and what my wife, the sociologist, would call the oldest old, and when they get past the point of life being remotely worthwhile. But I wanted to end this segment with something I hope you think is worthwhile. Yes, I wrote another song. Big musical day on Dave's Gone By. I hope you'll all kind of sing along. It's a real punky, fast number. I wanted to play it on guitar, but just you know, don't. I'm not quite good enough, not even remotely good enough to play punk guitar. But you can still sing along acapellically with me on Pull Out the Tube. 1, 2, 3, 4. Terry's in an awful way. She hasn't moved in years. Doctors keep her breathing, but she's dead behind the ears. Hubby wants to bring her from this world into the other. But he has two obstacles, a father and a mother. Maybe she'll wake up one day, hear the lawyers pleading. Until then, you've got to keep the intravenous feeding. Hubby said ridiculous. She's nothing but a mummy. Justice has agreed, so now they're emptying her tummy. Pull out the tube. Pull out the tube. Leave out the glory, glory, pull out the tube. Somewhere in the Vatican, the Pope has had a scare, waving at the Catholics and mumbling a prayer. Now he's stuck in ICU, it's fluent up his habit. Meat puree most every day, but liquid fish on salmon. Pull out the tube, pull out the tube. Leave out the glory, glory, pull out the tube. Granny's in a nursing home, she lives inside her head. Screams all day, cries all night, handcuffed to the bed. Once she was a beauty with 100 eager bows. Now she's just a monster with a menu in her nose. Pull out the tube, pull out the tube. Leave out the glory, glory, pull out the tube. Terry's looking thinner now, her eyes are sunken deep. Maybe she's in agony, but still she looks asleep. Starving is effective, but the final days are grim. At least when you're buried, you'll be supermodel trim. Pull out the tube, pull out the tube. Leave out the glory, glory, pull out the tube. One more time, pull out the tube, pull out the tube. Leave out the glory, glory, pull out the tube.
Oh my God, this is terrible.
What?
There are 168 hours in a week, but Dave's Gone By is only on 1 hour long.
I know, I'm just on Thursday night.
But that's not enough!
Why don't you get my CDs?
CDs?
All my complete shows are on compact disc. $14 a piece, or less if you buy a bunch. Just go to davesgoneby.com. Fully packaged, and they make a nice gift, too.
Well, my depression has cleared.
Great!
but not my psychosis. What chicken is this?
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB in Freeport, New York, and live streaming on the web at am1240wgbb.com. And it's time for a segment called Dave's Got Guests, and I do have one single guest and a rather singular guest at that. Now, a lot of people know him from TV, although not necessarily on some level by his face, because he was in quite a bit of different makeup, at least in one particular program. Gosh, I'm being very vague about this intro, but let me get specific. This person is also a theater person who has done quite a bit of Shakespeare. He's currently in King Lear, and that's running through April 17th at San Diego Rep. His name is Armin Shimerman, kind of an unlikely name for a theater and television star, but that's exactly what he is. Sci-fi people certainly will know who he is from Star Trek Deep Space Nine, where he played Quark, and also Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where he was Principal Snyder, but he doesn't sound quite so evil in person. So please welcome Armin Shimerman to the neighborhood. Armin, are you there?
Yes, Dave, here. Thank you for the very nice introduction.
You're very welcome, and thanks for being here with us in the neighborhood. How's King Lear going?
Doing quite well. Our houses are very large. We've had nice reviews. The audience, we had a talk back last night, and we had a dear man in the audience who was in tears after seeing the play. He was that moved. It's a very moving play, but obviously this gentleman, he had never seen Lear before, and this gentleman obviously was very taken with it.
Well, that's cool. By the way, the production is featuring the artistic director of San Diego Rep, Sam Woodhouse, is playing Lear, and Todd, is it Salovey or Salovey is director?
Salovey.
Salovey.
Director.
Is the director. And yes, by the way, the reviews, I don't know, I was going to ask if you read reviews or not, but obviously
I tend not to read the reviews until after the show is over, but people have been telling me they've been good, so.
Well, yes,
I'll go on their words.
The Union Tribune called you nimble, and other nice words about your performance as the Fool. Is this the first time you played that role in King Lear?
Yes, it is, although I came very close to playing this part in New York in the late 70s, early 80s. There was going to be a production of King Lear with Richard Burton, and it was going to be produced by Alexander Cohen. That production never actually happened because Mr. Burton, and I totally understand it now, Mr. Burton only didn't want to do matinees. He only wanted to do six performances a week. Alex wanted to do eight. That's understandable as well.
Right.
They couldn't agree on seven, and so the production never happened. And in that production, I was going to play the Fool as well.
Wow. And did you catch the Lear that they did just last season? I think Christopher Plummer was in it on Broadway. Did you?
No, I didn't. Since I'm located in Los Angeles, I didn't get a chance to see it. I have worked with Mr. Plummer before. We did Henry V at Stratford in Connecticut.
Wow. Cool. So you have quite a bit of experience in Shakespeare. I guess the first place to start is asking how playing Shakespeare is different and or the same as playing some of the more modern theatrical works.
Well, first thing, of course, is the language. And the language has to be mastered before you can really approach the roles adequately. Otherwise, the audience is going to be lost. The Elizabethans had a certain way of speaking, more importantly of writing, and it had something to do with Greek rhetoric, and once you've mastered the principles of Greek or Elizabethan rhetoric, you have a better handle on how to do Shakespeare. I teach that subject to actors around Los Angeles, and I find without that, it's impossible to understand what people are saying. With it, it becomes incredibly easy to understand what the actors are saying and what Shakespeare is writing. He put the words together in a certain way in order for his audiences to see how nimble, if I may use that word, how nimble they were with Elizabethan rhetoric.
So what's like the first bit of advice that you would give an actor specifically? I mean, obviously you're going to say make the words make sense.
Yes.
But what's something that you would tell the actor?
I'll give you a principle.
Yeah.
Absolutely. One of the principles of rhetoric is using what's called antithesis. Antithesis is simply the use of opposite ideas or opposite words. One of the more famous antitheses in Shakespeare is, of course, to be or not to be. Now, what you must do is show the audience the tension between the opposites. Once they begin to hear tension between words and how words are put together, they better understand what it is you're saying. So a modern actor might say, to be or not to be, that is the question. That's totally understandable to us because we've heard that line so many times. But really, a better trained actor would say, to be or not to be. In other words, make the tension between those things more apparent.
Well, actually, that's sounding a little bit Shatner-ish. But...
Well, in a sense, Mr. Shatner was a classical actor that came out of Stratford, Canada. Many of his Star Trek actors, Patrick Stewart, Rene Aubergenois, Avery Brooks, Kate Mulgrew, all of them are classically trained actors. And in fact, I've always thought that that Star Trek is looking for classically trained actors for its larger roles.
Okay, I guess that does kind of lead us very directly into the whole Star Trek thing. How did you become Quark?
Well, certainly Quark has a little to do with Richard III, if in the sense that before I was Quark, I was another Ferengi called Letek. Letek was perhaps the first Ferengi ever seen by the Star Trek audience. And there's a little bit of Richard III in Letek. You'll see that he has a slight hunch. He sort of limps a little. And my performance as Letek left an impression with the producers at Star Trek. And when they were looking for a Ferengi for Deep Space Nine, I certainly was in their mind. And I had some competing to do, some auditioning to do. But eventually they chose me, and I'm very happy that they did.
And was it a question, I mean, after a while, certainly you have all that latex and that makeup and stuff. Was it a point where when you first started doing the show, it took 3 hours to get into costume, and then they got it down to about 45 minutes? Or was it always 3 or 4 hours to just get to the point to get you on camera?
Well, to get me on camera, you're absolutely right. In the beginning, it was 3 hours, more makeup than costume. And eventually, my makeup lady, a genius, her name is Karen Westerfield, Karen got it down to 2 hours. We never really got it below 2 hours. So every day started with a two-hour makeup job. That was actually quite useful for me because I used the 2 hours to get up because my calls were often very early in the morning, say 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the morning. But more importantly, I'd used the 2 hours to memorize my lines for the day and get to know the people that I was going to be acting with. Many times the actors that I would do scenes with were also in makeup, and they'd be seated next to me. And if I didn't know them, we'd be able to have 2 hours to get acquainted and form a relationship, which was helpful on screen.
Well, that's pretty cool. Yeah.
So the 2 hours of makeup may sound like a bad thing when you first hear about it, but it was a useful tool to me as the years went by.
Here's something that struck me as kind of surprising. There are all these different Star Trek and Star Trek spinoffs and derivatives, and actors are hired for them, and they come out of the Shakespearean background and not necessarily out of an SF background. But you apparently have even written Star Trek novels. Have you written them, or are they into the genre?
There are certain science fiction actors who do have their novels ghostwritten. I won't mention any names. But
we already have, but okay, yeah.
Yes, indeed I have. But in my case, I have written 4 novels, and I have written all 4 of them. Certainly in the case of 3 of them, I had the partners, which in the first novel, I would say my partner wrote about 50%. But as I began to write more and more of the novels, I began to take on more and more of the responsibility. And indeed, the last novel, which is called Merchant Prince of Capital.
Oh, I'm sorry, I missed that. The last novel is called what?
The last novel is called Merchant Prince, A Capital Offense.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a trilogy of novels, all starting with the title Merchant Prince. But the last one, Capital Offense, I wrote pretty much by myself. I had somewhat of a help for the first maybe 20 pages, and the other 300 pages are all mine.
Did you write other kinds of material before you went into that genre, or... Were you always writing SF even before you became Quark or were acting in any of the Star Treks?
I wasn't much of a writer before then. When I was a child, in my teens, I had done a lot of writing and had gotten 1 or 2 poems published. But writing seemed like an important thing when I was a teenager, And then I was bitten by the bug, and when I went into acting, everything sort of fell by the wayside, and acting became paramount in my life. But while I was sitting in the trailer those long days, all those many years, I began to realize I was wasting my time just watching TV in my trailer. And someone came to me with the idea of writing, and that seemed very pleasant to me, and so I decided to take that up and filled my hours in the trailer and at home by writing, and it's become one of my passions, actually.
And it takes a special kind of imagination. I mean, I've tried to read SF novels, and my mind just doesn't go that way. It is different. It requires this kind of very big universe that's all tied in with all these ganglia, and I just get completely lost for about 50 pages. I mean, do you find that different of trying
yes,
to write something else?
I do. I write for a my novels are usually about one particular subject as opposed to a world.
Mm.
The world in my novels is not as important as the subject matter that I'm dealing with. My first novel had something to do with Elizabethan history, which I'm interested in. My second novel had to do with the media and with religion, and my third novel had to do with a particular political problem that's in the papers even today about enemy combatants and the Bush administration's use of that.
We should also mention that you got a bachelor's in English from UCLA, so you have that background in writing. How did you go from basically that level to being an actor and getting your first gigs, and what did you do to tide yourself over?
It was very easy to go from the English major to acting in Shakespeare because my specialization in English was Shakespeare.
Oh. Yeah.
So, yes, I graduated with a degree in English, but my emphasis was always on Shakespeare, Shakespearean studies, and my English professor, Dr. David Rhodes at UCLA, was very kind when I was taking my senior exam in his course. That turned out to be the same day that I needed to audition for the very prestigious Globe Theater, also here in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Rhodes was kind enough to let me miss the test so that I could audition for the theater. I came back and took the test the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Test the next day. Don't remember what my grade on the test was, but I certainly passed, and I also got the audition, got the role at the Globe that I had auditioned for. So it was a good week, and between college and my working at the Globe, there was no time between the two. I actually was working at the theater during graduation services at UCLA.
Wow.
What tided me over?
Yeah.
My experiences at the Globe that summer in 1972, I had many actors from New York who were telling me I should move to New York and look into the New York theater, and I was very fortunate. I moved to New York in 1975. In 1976, I was performing with the Public Theater in their production of Three Penny Opera with Raoul Julia.
Oh, my goodness. So that was your first Broadway role in Three Penny Opera?
My first, yes, and I did three others after that.
Which ones?
I went on from there almost immediately to do a production of St. Joan at the Circle in the Square. We did a Broadway show called Broadway by George Abbott. And my final Broadway show was Richard Rogers' musical, I Remember Mama. Mr. Rogers' last song that he wrote, I believe he wrote for me.
WGBB, the place for you and me. We're one big family. And let me make one thing clear. There's so many shows to hear, like Joyce Keller, the radio psychic. Wednesdays, 11 p.m., she's one fine, uncanny chick. And then there's Mike Shamari's Instrumental Invasion. Thursdays at 8, it's Sweeping the Nation. And Fridays at 6, if you can't get a date, there's Bonnie D. Graham telling you how to mate. Saturday nights, the Mike and Jimmy Show. For rock and roll comedy, the place to go. And make sure to listen on Sundays, too. At 7 p.m., it's Joe Salzone's Worldview. So many programs on 1240 AM. If you had half a brain, you tune in to them. Yes, WGBB is the place to listen all week long. Joyce Keller, Wednesdays at 11. Mike Shamari with Smooth Jazz, Thursdays at 8. Long Island's Dating with Bonnie D. Graham, Friday nights at 6. Mikey and Jimmy, 5:30 on Saturday nights. And Politics on Worldview with Joe Saldone, Sundays at 7. So if you love Dave's Gone By, give these other shows a try. They serve your community. If you listen, you'll know why. They're groovy and that's no lie. Come on now, don't be shy.
$15 an issue sounds like a lot to spend for a theater magazine, but what if every issue of that magazine were jam-packed with information, like what shows are bound for Broadway, what big stars are in town, and what shows on and off Broadway are worth seeing? What if there was a whole calendar of dance, opera, and cabaret? And what if every issue had more theater information than the New York Times, Variety, and The Hollywood Reporter put together? $15 sounds more reasonable, right? But guess what? A full year of Performing Arts Insider costs less than $14 an issue, and Dave's Gone By listeners get 10% off the subscription price, meaning you would pay just $12 an issue for all the listings, rumors, reviews, and more in Performing Arts Insider. TotalTheater.com has all the details, or call 516-295-1511 and ask about the theater magazine the professionals use and theatergoers love. Performing Arts Insider.
Mary, hark ye. Lend an ear. Tis I, Armin Shimmerman, begging you to list to Dave's Gone By on WGBB.
Bravo, bravo, bravo. Magnifico, fantastico. Not counting the one that you're in, because actors always say that, but what would be your favorite role? And it doesn't even have to be Shakespearean. But it can be.
I think my favorite role, because I've done it a number of times now, is probably Claudius from Hamlet. The reason is I now see Hamlet from Claudius's perspective, and so I love doing that role because although most people think of him as a villain, he's really a very complicated man, and I love being able to convince an audience that there's more to Claudius than just what Hamlet says of him.
Oh, I mean, I get that constantly. Like last night I was seeing the revival of the Glass Menagerie on Broadway, and basically what do you think of the mother there? I mean, she's quote-unquote the monster, she's intolerable, she's this, yeah, she's pushy, she's bossy, and I guess maybe I'm older, but I'm seeing up there a woman who's pretty darn desperate and very, very, you know, you feel not only sorry for her, but most of the time she's right.
Yeah,
which is kind of interesting. You don't get that when you first talk about Glass Menagerie. You say, oh, these poor, poor young
poor
people.
Children, yeah, living with this monster, exactly.
Yeah.
And as you see different productions and you see gifted actors who attempt the roles, they try to convince you of the rightness of their characters. And in fact, in King Lear, if I may make the transition,
sure.
The two what are usually called the evil sisters,
well,
you listen to what they have to say, they actually are in the right.
Yeah, the only time they get evil is when they strip him of all his, like, his people and his hangers-on. That's
exactly.
When we start to feel like, all right, they're going too far.
And in our production, as well as many, many other productions, one sees that the hangers-on are sort of rowdy people. They're sort of loud, obnoxious. And so...
They're like Falstaffs, you know, times 20 kind of thing.
Exactly. There's a whole bunch of Falstaffs and ague cheeks. And Toby Belcher's, and so the sisters, in a sense, are right to say, you know, you've got 100 rowdy people in my house, and I think, what do you need 100 for? We can do it with 50. So there's a sort of sense to what they're saying, and a logic, and a rightness to what they're saying. It's only after we see where it takes them that we begin to realize that they're not as good of daughters as perhaps they could be. But the truth of the matter is, if we look at parents and children's relationship, especially when parents get older and are in need of special care, sometimes children have a hard time dealing with their older parents, and that's what this play is about.
Well, yeah, I mean, the one thing, and I'm wondering how your production, or I should say, Todd Salivet's, you said before, Salivet, his production gets around the fact that the thing I could never get is that the whole show hinges on the king making a very rash, silly decision for no reason. It just sort of comes out of nowhere, and, you know, I just never got that. I mean, is there a way that you kind of, or the director, makes that seem realistic?
That is the problem in the play, in the sense that it happens so quickly. People haven't really settled in their seats yet when that decision is made, and a lot of times audiences will not be aware of how rash that decision is. It's a problem. I'm not sure that we solve it completely. It's really a problem in the play. You know, King Lear is perhaps Shakespeare's greatest play, and it's a little presumptuous of me to say, well, Shakespeare made a mistake here. But I think he did. I think he could have given us more of a relationship between Lear and Cordelia before Lear makes this rather stupid mistake.
I agree. And if you want to see how Santiago Rep tries to solve that problem, other problems, and to bring across the world of Shakespeare and King Lear, and you happen to be on the West Coast listening to this show, please, you have until April 17th to catch King Lear, starring Sam Woodhouse in the title role, and, of course, our guest Armin Shimerman playing the fool. And wondering if, as we go, I guess it would be quite appropriate if you can just give us a little, maybe a quote, a little taste of the fool fooling?
Sure. Let's see. There's a scene in the second act where the fool, who has been off stage for in our production, since the first scene in the script, he's not there at all until this scene in the second act. But he sees Lear for the first time. He's dealing with a character who he knows at that moment as Caius. Caius is really Lear's trusted counselor, Kent. But Kent is in disguise, as mm-hmm. many Shakespearean plays, we have a character in disguise. In our production, I sort of recognize Kent, and it's sort of a secret between the two of us. But he's talking to Kent when he comes on stage and says, let me hire him too. Here's my coxcomb. Sirrah, you would best take my coxcomb. Why? Taking one's part that's out of favor. And I can't stop. Smile as the wind sits. I'll catch cold shortly. There, take my coxcomb. Why, this fellow hath banished two of his daughters and done the third a blessing against his will. If you follow him, thou must needs wear my coxcomb. So that's a little part of Lear. Coxcomb, of course, is the hat that which your viewers can't see, which is the fool's cap. And so he's offering the fool's cap to Kent because any man who's following Lear must be a fool.
Yeah, and also we have to explain for the FCC that coxcomb is a hat and not something, well, I won't even get into that. But anyway, Armin...
That's your problem, not mine.
Armin Shimerman, thank you so much for being with us in the neighborhood. Best of luck with King... Oh, and what's up for you after King Lear, by the way?
I will hopefully get back to writing my next novel, and I'm sure my agents will find me some work on TV ASAP.
I'm sure they will. Thank you so much. Dave's Gone By listeners know I love a good play on words, but let me say a good word on plays, my plays, collected in a lovely book called Marriage, Babies, and the End of the World. Comedies that range from strange to deranged, from sad to satirical, fun to read, and unmistakably Dave. Just $20 hardcover, $12 soft. Put down that crappy bestseller and pick up some laughs. 516-295-1511 or davesgoneby.com. Is there anything better than an hour of Dave's Gone By? Yes, more hours of Dave's Gone By. After you finish listening to the show on Thursday nights, surf your web over to dfsxradio.com and hear a vintage episode of Dave's Gone By every Thursday at 8. And if you miss that, they replay it at 11 Eastern Standard Time. So remember, hear Dave's Gone By Thursday nights at 7 on GBB, and then hear older episodes on dfsxradio.com at 8 and 11 every Thursday. It's all the Dave you could ever want! Kinda.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. Thank you so much for listening on this April 7th. Thanks also to Armin Shimerman, my special guest in the neighborhood. Remember that he is playing the fool in King Lear at San Diego Repertory Theater now through next Sunday. So, if you're going to be flying westward or you've got relatives the L.A. way, sounds like it's worth a visit. For more information, visit sandiegorep.com. And, as long as you're web surfing, take a little ride over to davesgoneby.com if you haven't already. Now, not only can you find out more about my book, Marriage, Babies, and the End of the World, and buy CDs of entire Dave's Gone By shows, including this one, as soon as they come out, we pop them on CD, $14 a piece, including all shipping and handling. And also, on the Days Gone By website, you can see pictures. There's a bunch of links to websites and guests that we've had on the program. There are song lyrics. There's information about how to advertise on the show, and the rates are really, really cheap. And the website is a good way to keep up with future episodes of Days Gone By. For example, over the next 3 weeks, I'm still juggling the dates, but these are all definite. The next 3 weeks, we'll have some great guests on the program. We'll be talking theater, this time to a playwright. He has a show also on the West Coast, just like Armin, but he's a homegrown Long Island writer. He actually teaches at SUNY Farmingdale, not playwriting, but biology. Go figure. Anyway, his name is D.T. Arcieri, or Danny Arcieri to his friends, and he has a dark comedy called Japanese Death Poem going up at Theater 40 in L.A. Directing the show is Stephen Tobolowsky, the character actor you'd recognize from Deadwood and Memento, and especially Groundhog Day, where he played Ned Ryerson. Stephen Tobolowsky is directing Japanese Death Poem, and co-starring in it is the one and only Julie Haggerty, that adorable, one-of-a-kind actress from Airplane and Midsummer Night Sex Comedy and Lost in America. So, Danny Arcieri is in good company, and he'll be keeping me company in the neighborhood one of these Thursdays in April, as will Stephen Tobolowsky and Julie Haggerty. They're all going to be guests in the weeks ahead, as will one of the founding lights of the post-punk new wave movement of the mid-1970s. After the Sex Pistols and the Damned and the Clash, a more playful sensibility came into the revolutionary English rock of that time. The artists were still angry, but they were more ready to acknowledge their pop antecedents, to look more internally for things to write about, and to be more whimsical in what they were doing. And a goodly number of those singer-songwriters were on the Stiffs label, the best known and most prolific, of course, Elvis Costello. The most unusual, Ian Dury, a one-legged pub crawler who added a dose of jazz and music hall to his punk. There was Nick Lowe, the most directly commercial of the bunch, working with Dave Edmunds. And then there was Eric Goulden, a gangly, greasy, grinning fellow, barely out of his teens, with a honking, squeaky voice that wasn't even on par with Johnny Rotten, let alone Johnny Mathis. And yet, Reckless Eric wrote a handful of the catchiest, bounciest songs in all of that musical era, and if anyone seemed primed to match the consistent output of music and musical growth of Elvis, it was Eric. And he tried for a time, but it wasn't really meant to be, especially when, for years, he spent more time battling the bottle than gripping the guitar. And he kind of existed on the margins for a long time, still releasing albums now and then, and putting his life back together in England, which he did several years back. He wrote an autobiography about it, which was published in the UK, and he's become a bit higher profile again in America, because he's got a new album called Bungalow High. He's got a girlfriend who lives on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, so when he visits her, he ends up playing the occasional solo gig, which he did in March at the Knitting Factory. Unfortunately, I couldn't get him here on time to promote that engagement, but I will have Reckless Eric on this program one of these Thursdays in April. We'll hear new stuff from his new album, his first albums too, and lots of chat about his career, his label mates back at Stiff, what he thinks of the craft of songwriting. That one may surprise you. Reckless Eric coming to Days Gone By. And I want to thank all of you for coming to Days Gone By tonight. Thanks to my sponsors, Hewlett Minuteman Press, 1315 Broadway in Hewlett, and TotalTheater.com, publishers of Performing Arts Insider Theater Magazine. Thanks as always to Program Director Tom Ross, and to my darling wife, Joyce. Don't forget that you can hear another episode of Days Gone By starting right now, 8 p.m. on DFSXRadio.com. The link is on my homepage, davesgoneby.com, or you can stay with WGBB and hear Mike Shamari's instrumental invasion of smooth jazz till 8 o'clock, and then I'll be back with a different program called Filler Up. It's an hour of music, just music, moving from the sublime to the ridiculous, including The Roaches, Ravi Shankar, Tiny Tim, and Tom Lehrer. There's a mix for you, and that's all tonight at 9. Please email me with your comments and suggestions, davesgoneby@aol.com. Please write to me with comments, suggestions, and cold hard cash, Dave's Gone By, P.O. Box 62, Hewlett, New York, 11557-0062. That's Box 62 in Hewlett, 11557-0062. We're going to go out with a little R.E.M. in honor of the Pope's passing, but we shall pass this way again next Thursday, 7 p.m., April 14th. Until then, don't miss your days going by. This is Dave Lefkowitz. Good night. People get ready. And gone by.
Baby.